Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Thursday, September the 16th. I wanted to say before we go any further, this is Independence Day for our Mexican friends. We do have a few people who listen down in Mexico. Of course, there are many Mexicans in the United States. And so happy Independence Day to all of our friends in Mexico. It was on this day in 1810. 1810 or 1811, my history is failing me, that Mexico formally declared its independence, but of course it took a long time for that to be squared away. It took almost 100 years for everything to be to settle down into the Mexico that we know today. Well, tonight we're going to be chatting with our friend Michael Bargo from the Windy City of Chicago. Michael has been very active in the courts here lately with some cases. He's going to bring us up to date on that, some interesting developments that he'll share with us. I think it's good news that Michael is going to share with us tonight. So let me say hello to Michael. How are you, Michael, all the way up in the great windy city of Chicago? How are you?
I'm doing great, thank you. And it's like the weather in the mid and upper 70s.
All right. Well, here it's in the 80s. It's starting to cool off a little bit, but it's not, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. There's always one last, you know, summer always has one last, as I like to say, one last week or farewell of summer, and that's still pending. It'll probably happen sometime in the next week or so, and then it'll become a little bit more reasonable once we get into officially the autumn here in Texas. Well, I got to tell you, before we get to your case, and I'm anxious to hear about it, I'm sure you're familiar with the Texas heartbeat law that was signed by the governor on the 1st of September. It was challenged to the Supreme Court. The court came back 5-4. The court really didn't work on the case. It simply said, I guess it said it just wanted to leave it alone. And so it stayed as the law of Texas. The Biden Department of Justice filed an injunction a few days ago, and a judge today refused to, whatever the correct word is, to file or accept the injunction. So the heartbeat law is in effect. It's still in effect. It has not been eliminated, and so give me your reaction to that, because I'm also going to ask you to react to something else, but your reaction to, at least so far, how the heartbeat law has survived 2 weeks, Michael.
Well, I think it's great. You're speaking about the Supreme Court of Texas, right?
No, I'm talking, well, okay, the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, 5-4, didn't touch it, and now... Yeah, the federal Supreme Court is the one that 5-4 didn't touch it.
Oh, good.
And then it was the Department of Justice, the Biden Department of Justice, that went after the law, requested an injunction. I may not be using the right words, but wanted the law to be stopped. And a federal judge said no. So that's two victories in less than a month, Michael.
Well, the whole reason for that is Texas has the right as a state to rule on a lot of issues like that.
Well, so, yeah, go ahead.
So the people of Texas spoke through this law, through their elected representatives, and the Supreme Court wisely and accurately, and I think constitutionally, declined to get involved.
This is exactly, and you're almost reading my mind, because that's exactly what I was going to say, that I think the Supreme Court said, hey, look, the people of Texas, through their legislature, have the right to regulate abortion if they want to. And if the Democrats want to change that, they can get elected and do the same thing in reverse and eliminate the law. So I think you're right. I think that that is exactly the view of the court, 5-4, which is, I think, an excellent move. I also think, and that's why I like to get your reaction to this, I also think that the Supreme Court is looking ahead to the Mississippi law, which is going to show up in next June. It'll be one of the opinions that they write next year. And the Mississippi law is a lot more, maybe more conventional, if I could put it that way. That one says 15 weeks, no abortion after 15 weeks. The criticism of the Texas law is that it's heartbeat, and sometimes a heartbeat can be 6 weeks, which means a woman may not even know she's pregnant, or that's what the argument against it. And they say, well, gee, I don't even know I'm pregnant, and now I cannot get an abortion. That's the argument against it. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but that's the argument. And whereas the law in Mississippi is 15 weeks, which is more conventional, more a conventional regulation of abortion, not just here in the United States, but in other countries as well, Michael.
Yeah, I would. My comment about abortion and the beginning of heartbeat is that the very beginning of heartbeat is kind of irrelevant, because if a woman wants an abortion, she wants an abortion. She's not going to care if the heartbeat started a week or two sooner or later. You know what I mean?
No, I think you're right.
I don't think that's not going to matter. And what I don't like is centuries ago, maybe 300 years ago, there used to be a law in England that you could not that once a baby reached the stage of quickening, which means the state at which it had like a nervous reflexes, and its nervous system was operating, they looked down upon abortions. They didn't like to have an abortion if the baby was moving on its own,
mm-hmm.
and that's kind of a similar thing, but it's more directed toward the nervous system than the heartbeat.
Right.
But I think either distinction is wrong, because we all know in the Catholic Church, Pope John Paul II said in the Catholic Church that we must respect life from the moment of conception.
Right. Exactly. And that has been my position all my life, that life
right.
begins at conception. But, of course, not everybody wanted to believe that. But I do think it's interesting how technology has suddenly become the biggest friend of the pro-life movement. When Roe v. Wade was written in 1948, we had very little technology to check up on the life of a baby inside the mother. But now we have...
It was 73.
Yeah, well, that was 73 when it was passed, when it was written.
Yeah,
January of 1973. But my point is that when that Roe v. Wade was written, there was very little knowledge about what was inside the mom, other than the emotional that you were pregnant. You could hear the baby moving or whatever. But now we have so much information. I can speak on a personal level. We have two grandsons, as you know, and you can see. You could go to my son's house, and his wife would put pictures of the. Of the preborn baby on the refrigerator. She would show pictures of the preborn on the refrigerator.
The sonogram.
That's right. And you could see that. Obviously, you couldn't do that in 1973. You couldn't do that in 1985. Maybe in the 90s you could. But now it's such detail. And the heartbeat, the idea that you can hear a heartbeat, is just incredible in itself. I mean, just the idea that you can... that someone inside of a woman has a heartbeat, that gives that baby a human quality that it never really had before in any abortion discussion. Because as I was saying the other day, I was locally here on Telemundo, and I was saying that that what makes the abortion law different, or the heartbeat law different, is that for the first time in my discussions of abortion, and I've debated abortion many times, for the first time, we're actually talking about the baby inside, because all of a sudden, the baby inside, all of a sudden is, if I could put it this way, the star of the movie. We're talking about the baby inside. It's no longer my body, my body, my body. It's now a heartbeat inside. So I didn't mean to get long-winded about this, but I just thought that you know, I agree with you that I think the Supreme Court is sending a message that, hey, Texas can do this. But I also think this heartbeat law, the idea that you can listen to a heartbeat, just changes everything. I don't know how, I mean, I'm going to say something. I'm going to generalize. I know that's always difficult to do. But I think that if you were to put an earphone in a young woman's ear and say, listen to the heartbeat of your baby, I don't think most of them would go through the abortion, Michael.
No, and not only that, Silvio, but I saw back in the 80s, you can see the heartbeat on a sonogram. If you're at the, I went with my wife when she was pregnant for the exams, and you could see the heart beating. It's like an X-ray.
That's right. And I remember that too. You know, our sons were born in 87, 88, 90, so they were born in that time frame. And I remember pictures. I remember photographs. I don't remember specifically the heart beating. But definitely technology has turned everything upside down, which is ironic because for years, you know, we kept relying on prayer and we kept relying on you know, the goodwill of men and women. And now all of a sudden a machine is actually giving us more information than we ever could have imagined, Michael.
Yeah, it's really interesting. The like I said, the concept of quickening, they knew that a child was moving and that it had a heartbeat back 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And when were they able to determine that? At what point of the pregnancy?
When the baby was moving in response to external stimulation.
Okay. All right. Okay. That's interesting. No, I didn't know that. I didn't know that was the rule in England. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I've been looking up all the abortion stuff recently because I'm writing my own case on it.
Yeah.
But the thing, that's really fascinating. The whole idea about human life is just it's just hard to believe. But I've been studying the Roe v. Wade cases. I read the transcripts of the two oral arguments in 71 and 72.
Mm-hmm.
And then in early 73, they made the ruling, and I read all that. But the thing that impressed me was with the questions that the transcript reveals everything word for word that the judges asked about, about the case. Sarah Wellington was representing the pro-abortion people. I was really shocked, Silvio, to see how little the Supreme Court judges knew about science. They have a very low science education.
Right.
They did not ask any detailed questions.
Yes. Of course, we have now for the first time, maybe not the first time, but we do have a mother now. We actually have a mother in the Supreme Court. And she, I think, mother of seven, I believe. The other two women, I don't think, have any children. And Sandra Day O'Connor, I think she had children when President Reagan appointed her. But,
yes,
you know, having a member of the Supreme Court who has given birth five or six times, I think adds an element to those conversations that the justices are having. You know, it's different for a man to talk about childbearing or for a woman who doesn't have any children, but when you have a mother of five there in the room, it makes it a little different. I mean, I think this, the selection of Miss Barrett, Justice Barrett, Amy Barrett, I think was perhaps one of the most amazing things that President Trump did, without question. I mean, that's going to be his biggest legacy. And it could be next June if Roe v. Wade, if it's not overturned, at least states are once again allowed to regulate abortion, which is really what I want. That's what I want. I want Texas to be able to do what Texas wants to do. Illinois can do what Illinois wants to do, and so on, Michael.
You mentioned Sandra Day O'Connor. I don't think it was Roe. I think it was another abortion case. But she was actually... In simple terms, Sandra Day O'Connor was the smartest person. Her comments her written comments about abortion were the ones you and I would most seriously agree with, and they were the most perceptive. And she said there are other issues other than the simplistic thing, which is wrong, that a woman – Roe v. Wade was all about whether a woman has a privacy right to abort a child. And as I'm writing in my case, the concept of privacy is never mentioned in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, or any significant Supreme Court ruling. Because just because something is done privately doesn't mean it can be unethical or immoral or criminal.
Right. Now let's talk about your case because it's fascinating. But let me just ask you one more question about Roe v. Wade, because my understanding now the Fourth Amendment protects your private papers, right? Your privacy in that sense.
Against search and seizure.
Okay, that's right. That's right. Exactly. Not the Fourth Amendment. You're exactly right. It protects your privacy against government walking into your home and stealing your documents without a warrant. That's correct. But it was the supporters of Roe v. Wade always say, well, it's a woman's privacy or whatever. I never really thought that was a very serious explanation, because
I never looked at it.
But I mean, I don't understand what privacy has to do with abortion.
It doesn't have anything to do with it. It's just a very poor excuse. It's like there are a lot of things I like about feminism. The whole thing you and I agree is that women should have equal access to education, to job opportunities, equal education, equal access. All that stuff is great. But when they criticize men and they ignore the role of men, did you know that Roe v. Wade never mentions the word father or dad or DNA or father's role? Anything to do, the father is never mentioned in Roe v. Wade. It's a total feminist manifesto. It only talks about the mother like she runs everything,
right?
which is partially, once she becomes pregnant, it is under – it's in her body, but she only becomes pregnant when she receives the DNA from the man. So he has a role to play too.
Right. And that, I think we're going to take a break, and then I want to come back to your case, because I know that's a big portion of your case, the role of men. But I have felt for quite some time that men are discriminated by Roe v. Wade in the sense that, if you get a woman, we'll take a break and then we'll come back and I'll let you explain your case. But I just wanted to set the table for the next segment, that if a man gets a woman pregnant, we make the assumption that he's not interested in the baby, that he just wants to, put it away or get it off the table or whatever. And that may be true. I don't deny that some men say, well, I don't want anything to do with it, get an abortion. But I think there may be other men who have a different idea. And, who may have a more intimate relationship with the woman, that it wasn't just a one-night stand or something like that. And I think those men, have a reason to want to at least have something to say on whether or not the baby's aborted. And that's what your case is a great deal about. We're going to take a little break. And then when we come back, Michael is going to tell us about his case, and I'm looking forward to it. Be right back. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, with our friend Michael Bargo up in the windy city of Chicago. I guess the good news up there, Michael, I don't remember if you're a baseball fan or not, but the White Sox are going to be in the postseason. So I'm sure the people in the South Side are pretty excited about the White Sox being in the postseason. Unfortunately, the Cubs will have to wait for another year, as they say.
Cubs gave away what? Four of their best players.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I couldn't believe it. Chris Bryan, Rizzo, I mean, all these guys traded away. I mean, I hope they got something good for them, because those were really good quality players.
Well, the story you read online about that was that the Ricketts family bought the Cubs? They have a group of investors who want to pay, want to essentially buy the Cubs. And so the reason they let out, they let off those big players was that reduced the price of the Cubs team by $50 million.
Well, I believe it. I believe it because they had some big names in there. Chris Bryant, the third baseman, Rizzo, the first baseman, Baez, the second baseman. I mean, they had some big names who I'm sure were worth a lot of money. Well, let's talk about your case, your abortion case. Your case is rooted on the idea of the father, and that fascinates me. So tell me about it. Go ahead and tell us about the case and where you are and where you're going with it.
Well, if I can say it very quickly, this case, I have six cases, five already filed in federal court, three went to the Supreme Court. And this is my number six is going to be the abortion case. And I, honestly, I'm being very honest. I think this is this. I don't think it. I know it. The sixth case was God-inspired because I never studied Roe v. Wade. I figured, well, the abortion right for a woman is a done deal. Nothing much. A lot of different laws have come up, a lot of argument, and it's always been able to survive. So I never really thought about it. And then all of a sudden, I'm not kidding. I was watching TV in the living room. And all of a sudden it hit me, I can file against Roe v. Wade. And I had never thought about it. The whole and I knew what the argument would be. Well, here's my argument. Illinois has a statute that says if a woman becomes pregnant, single or married, she doesn't have to tell her husband she's getting an abortion. She can just go and get it. And there's no record of it. Up to two, all records of the abortion must be destroyed by 2 years. And the husband has no say or anything to do about it. And I'm sure a lot of husbands are tremendously hurt that they can't, even if they get a girlfriend pregnant, they might think it'd be a great idea to have their own child. So here's my argument, that since a woman does not, a woman has a monthly cycle for one, a woman can get pregnant 100 hours of the month. She's a normal, healthy woman, 4.25 days. That can go on for 350 or 400 months of her life. She only becomes pregnant when the man donates his DNA to the child. So the controlling factor in pregnancy is the man's donation. So my argument then is, well, that gives him an interest in the life of the child. The child would not exist without the man. His contribution, at least the DNA contribution, is exactly equal to the mother's. And so then my argument is he has standing then to protect the life of the child, which should be as much his as it is the mother's.
Right.
And not only that, I read a survey reported that 52% of women who get an abortion later on regret ever having had an abortion. A lot of young women, so if they go to college in a different state, they find themselves pregnant, they may be in a real panic, and there's no one to help, their parents, they may not be able to talk to their parents about it. And this is very unfortunate because a lot of these women don't want to, and they feel pressured into it.
Right.
Now, of course, you and I don't approve of an abortion, but I'm just saying we have to give pregnant women more support.
Right. Well,
when women are married,
if I may just jump in for a second, forgive me for interrupting you, but this is where I always recommend to the listeners to check out that movie that came out 4 or 5 years ago called Unplanned, based on the story of Abby Johnson, because that's exactly what you see in the movie, which is, I think, a very fair depiction of the clinics. You know, you have this 19-year-old girl in college who gets pregnant, and you're right. She doesn't want to tell her parents. She doesn't know what to do. She's frightened. She's scared. And, you know, the abortion becomes an easy way, if you will, of getting rid of the problem. And I think you're right. I think we need to be helping these young women. I also want to say something. Forgive me for interrupting you again, but just as a follow-up to what you just said, that if you go around most churches, either Catholic or Christian churches or whatever, you're going to see that most of them have ministries to work with women who've had abortions. There's a very famous one, Rachel's Vineyard, which I've read a little bit about, and they actually have, you know, they treat women who've had abortion, and it's a very painful experience, Michael.
Yeah. It's a tragedy because a lot of women don't they don't feel they have an option, and they're under enormous stress. And even though the man is involved in starting the pregnancy, once the woman is pregnant, the man can just take off, and the woman is stuck on her own. And if they're in a regular paying job or they're going to college, they may feel in a corner. And they should. Our society and our culture should do a lot more to help women who become pregnant than it does.
Right. And very often these are like I said, very young women. There's a reason why so many abortion clinics are at university towns. There's a reason for that, because that's where a lot of their business is. And many times there are these young women who really don't know what to do. But on the other hand, and this is where I think your case is so interesting, to assume that men don't care 100%, I think is an injustice on men. I bet that there's a lot of guys who have a relationship with a young woman, and she gets pregnant, and these guys, I think many guys would say, okay, look, if you don't want the baby, have it, and we'll find a family for it, or I'll take it. No. But at the very least, the father should have a say on it. And I also think, Michael, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the abortion option has in a sense given men an easy way out, because there's no responsibility for what you did.
Well, some men look for an easy way out. Some women do too.
Right.
Some women use free abortion. Some poor women use abortion as a form of birth control, which is horrendous, but that's
right.
A fact. But to finish my explanation is, so what remedy am I suggesting? I'm suggesting that when a young woman becomes pregnant, she is legally obligated to send a certified letter to the guy or inform him, even put an ad in the newspaper that she is pregnant, and then she must, and the man must be allowed 30 or 40 days to assert his custody of the child. He can say, wait a minute, he can go to court and file and say, I am the father of this child. She admitted that I'm the father, and I am willing to accept whatever I can pay for. And once the child is born, the father takes immediate legal custody. He doesn't have to go to court and fight for it or anything. And then once the child is his, he can give it to his mother, his sister, his relative, anybody. Or if he's wealthy, he can hire a nanny to watch it all day long. You know what I mean? There should be options, because half the child is the man's, and the man should have a legal option to compel the woman to complete the pregnancy. And I think a lot of women would be relieved and grateful for a chance to have the child born.
Well, I think so. I think so. Again, I don't know off the top of my head what percentages of pregnancies, in what percentage of pregnancies would a man be interested in having the baby or having the woman have the baby. I don't know if it's 10%, 20%, 30%. I have no idea. But the perception or the explanation has always been, or at least the defense of abortion has always been, it's a woman's body and she is the only one who decides.
No, because she didn't get herself pregnant.
Well, that's it. And the thing is, and more than likely, okay, and I was listening to this the other night on a talk show. They always use the rape and the incest excuse, and they say, well, rape or whatever. But that's like 1 or 2% of all the abortions are because of rape.
Right.
It's a very small number.
That's not an argument. The feminists tend to be very extreme in their arguments.
Right. Well, exactly. And the fact is, we wouldn't have a national debate on abortion if the abortions were only, regarding rape and incest, because they're, frankly, it wouldn't be an issue. But I've always felt that men are sort of kept out of the conversation, that it becomes, it's her body. Well, there's a guy in the picture too who at least should have something to say about what happens with that abortion. He shouldn't find out, 5 years later, that, oh, yeah, I had an abortion of that baby that we made. I mean, I think that would be pretty – I would feel pretty bad about that. And I think many men would feel the same way.
Well, I'm very close to my children. I was always a freelance writer-photographer, and I was very, very fortunate. When we had children, I was the primary caretaker. I only worked a few hours a day, so when the kids were little, my wife breastfed our kids. and they grew so fast that when they were four months old, they went from being breastfed to table food. They never had baby food. My kid, listen to this. You can believe it, Sylvia. I have three children.
Mm-hmm.
Our first was a daughter. She grew 3 inches in her first 10 weeks of life. My first son grew 5 inches because they have the 10-week as a, you know, it's a specific date. You are required at 10 weeks exactly to have to bring the baby to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
So my daughter grew 3 inches. My first son grew 5, and my second son grew only 3.5 because the day he was born, he dropped on the head in the back left side of his head. He had a big bump and he was crabby for 2 weeks. He wouldn't nurse well, but he's big, and he's 6'2" now anyway. That's big.
That's right. No, I think he did okay. I think he did okay. But you know, the point is now where in the legal process is your case right now? I mean, I know that all these things.
Oh, I
take
haven't
steps.
Finished. I haven't finished writing it yet.
Okay,
I'm working
all right.
it up now. The argument I have all done. I'm working at it every day. I have dozens and dozens of court references, you know, of established cases. I'm wrapping it up now. I had to distract myself with the Madigan Rules case for
right.
about a month. So I'm going back to the abortion case now. But it's good to be away from it for a month. Now I see it, you know, almost like a stranger for the first time. And it's really excellent because I'm bringing up issues that have never been addressed. No
right.
one ever talks. And I told you, Roe v. Wade, and in fact, I've gone through probably three dozen cases now, abortion cases from all different time periods all around the country.
Mm-hmm.
The word father is never mentioned unless it's that the father must pay child support or alimony.
Right, but that's usually after the fact, after the baby's born. In other words,
right.
Yeah, the child support comes into play after the baby is born. But I argue that I think men, if a young, see, the problem is, and you said it earlier, you say, you know, these young women are scared and they think, oh my gosh, I'm going to get stuck with this baby. Nobody's going to support me. My parents are going to be angry with me. And I'm going to be all alone without money. I'm going to have to quit school, all this kind of stuff, you know, because I have a baby.
Right.
And I'm not saying that that couldn't happen. But I think if you made the man responsible, at least economically, for that baby, the young woman wouldn't get stuck by herself.
Well, right now, what my case would do is compel the woman to inform the man she's pregnant. And who knows before if the woman never told the guy she's pregnant.
Right.
The guy could have been the most wonderful guy from a beautiful, gigantic family, and he would love to have a new family. They would love to have a new baby in the family, but they never had the opportunity because they were never allowed to tell people that they were pregnant or they were
right.
terrified of it. So my case will just open up the discussion. And the one thing I want to say is you can be sure that in Mexico, before the Spanish, when Mexico had a lot of tiny, small communities,
mm-hmm.
that we didn't have this isolation today. And the same thing with me and my ancestors.
Yeah.
When there are women living in a small village in Europe or Central America or, you know, in Native American tribes, the women all grouped together and helped the pregnant
right.
women.
No, I think you're probably right about that. No question about it. I think that's the way it used to be, even here in the United States, but years ago. But I think that the assumption is often made that a woman who gets pregnant, it's a rape or a one-night stand, or, you know, she meets a guy and they do something and she gets pregnant. Mike, I'm gonna guess, because I don't have any numbers. Maybe you'll come up with numbers in your studies.
Right.
But I'm gonna guess, and I'm gonna be conservative. That half of the time when a woman gets pregnant, she's had an ongoing relationship with the guy who gets her pregnant. It could be they've been seeing each other for months. It's not a one-night stand. It's not, ooh, we went out, we drank too much, and I got pregnant. My sense that it's an ongoing relationship, which means that if the baby was born, you might even have some marriages that happen because of it, Michael.
Yeah, well, of course, and that's been true throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think the main difference today is that in our current American culture and society, that
yes.
a young woman is very, very isolated.
Absolutely,
and that the Native Americans and the Native Europeans it was always relatives and sisters and neighbors who were more than willing to help a young woman take care of her baby.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I see that in my family. I mean, I see that in my family. When someone has a baby, you know, everybody comes in and does whatever they can. Well, so you're working on the abortion case. Maybe you can give us an update the next time. Take a couple of minutes and talk about the other case that you're very excited about. We don't have a lot of time, but if you maybe in a couple of minutes, just give us a summary of it, please.
Oh, the Madigan Rules
yes,
case,
please.
Right? What's interesting is when I first mentioned this to people, they say, oh, Michael Madigan runs everything. Well, I used to think Michael Madigan ran everything through under-table corruption. He would get campaign donations. He would do favors, this and that. But no, he actually changed the rules of the Illinois House to where he was in control of everything. You're not going to believe this, but right now there are two big parties in Illinois. The giant one is the dominant one is the Democrat Party, and then the minority party is Republican. It is a state law right now, a rule of the Illinois House, that the Speaker of the House, whoever that Speaker might be, chooses the chairs, co-chairs, and vice chairs for all the committees for both the majority party and the minority. It used to be that the minority party chose their own chairman of their committees.
Right.
So before Madigan got in, I went back to the 1982 rules. That's actually at the federal court right now, that we should go back to the 82 rules, who had the common sense to say the majority party picks the majority chairs and the minority picks the minority chairs.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, that's what...
of course. Yeah, that's Robert's Rules of Order.
Yeah, that's been around for a long time. I mean, that's the whole point of having, I mean, that's the only way you can have, I mean, that's the only way that the minority can be represented. I mean, they don't have the votes. I understand they don't have the votes. But still, when you give them at least an opportunity to name a chairman or a committee or something, at least they get to speak their mind.
And their voters have some say. It may be weak and small by comparison, but they have some say in the policies that are passed. Right now, they don't.
Right.
There's another outrageous rule that I filed against as a voting rights violation. The Speaker of the Illinois House can pick a rules committee. It's got five members: three are the majority party Democrats and two are the Republicans, and they can meet off campus. And this is what the rule uses: the term off campus. They can meet at a bar, you know, at a hotel,
mm-hmm.
at a restaurant, at a hotel, anything they want. And listen to this, Silva, you will not believe this, but this is the wording of it, that all bills for the appropriation of money from all 30 committees of the Illinois House can be taken by the three members of the Speaker and his two majority members, the three Democrats. They can change them as much or as little as they want, and then the next day, whatever they choose, they can put those new appropriation bills on the floor of the House, and the House has 1 hour to vote on.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible. It's pretty incredible what goes on. And ironically, the land of Lincoln, you know, you would think the land of Lincoln would be an example of democracy. And unfortunately, the state of Illinois needs a lot of reform, to say the least. Well, we're just about out of time. I want to thank you so much for your updates. And obviously the abortion case is one that I really want to follow, because I agree with you on the role of men or the fact that men have been excluded for years about this. And I think it's about time. And hopefully this is all going in that direction. Michael, you have the law here in Texas, the heartbeat law, the Mississippi law coming up. I think you'll see a lot of other states follow the example of Texas with the heartbeat law. And maybe we're headed in the direction where we can bring this awful thing called abortion to an end, or at the very least, we can regulate it.
Well, the good news is, I'd like your listeners to know, is that the number of abortions has gone down by 39%.
Well, that's great. That's a good thing.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah. And that hopefully, I'm sure that's a combination of reasons. Maybe people are thinking more about it. Maybe they're taking better care of themselves. Maybe they're using preventive measures. Whatever the case, any time that a life, any time that you can, I was joking, and I'll say this last thing, and then I'll go. I was joking with a reporter the other day here locally in the Spanish station. And I said, you know, this last week, because of the Texas abortion law, the number of abortions has been reduced significantly. Maybe you can interview all of those babies who will be born and who will be teenagers in 15 or 16 years and ask them if it was a good idea for them to get a chance to live. Because there is a great line from former President Reagan. Former President Reagan used to say that everybody that he knows who supports abortion is alive. And that,
yeah,
you know, that is a very profound statement by our 40th president.
And also, I've never met a person who wished they were aborted.
Well, that's it. That's, in fact, I said that one time. I was debating a Democrat on TV, and I said, you know, I am so happy your mom did not abort you, because I would have never been able to debate you. And well, she didn't like it, but I think she knew that I was right. But, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us and giving us your input, as always, and keep me posted, and we'll do this often, because I enjoy it a great deal. And I think
you
do a great job in these activities that you're involved in, and it's always a lot of fun for me to hear about it. So thank you so much for
like
being
I said, you're welcome. It's amazing to me that the Roe v. Wade has such huge flaws in it. I'm shocked.
I know. Well, listen, I mean, there are people who believe in abortion who think that Roe v. Wade was a horrible case, just constitutionally, that is. Not morally, but constitutionally. And one of the best articles that I ever read about Roe v. Wade was written by none other than David Brooks of the New York Times, who said that Roe v. Wade was responsible for the total breakdown of civility in the U.S. Senate. Because every time you have a nomination for the Supreme Court, it all turns into an argument about Roe v. Wade. And look at what happened to Kavanaugh. Look at the extent that people were willing to go to destroy a good man. It was just all about abortion.
Just imagine, Silvio, if I win my case in the Supreme Court, that abortion thing will disappear then.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'm going to keep an eye on it, and you just let me know. I'm sure it's going to take some effort, but you're a persistent guy. I'm sure you can do it. But you keep me informed.
Well, it'll take a few years.
Oh, I'm sure.
I never quit on a case. I have three in the Supreme Court, and two more are already in federal courts on the way.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it'll take a while, but but I think the Supreme Court is moving in your direction, so that's a good thing.
Great. Thing.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks for the opportunity. It's been great, and I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. Our good friend Michael Bargo from Chicago. I forgot to tell you that he's a writer. He's a political columnist and a very good guy that we enjoy chatting with a great deal. Thank you for listening. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we'll talk to you later.